spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
To Heal DC. This is Joni, and you were just listening to Sweet Honey in the Rock. A lot of those words, although they were singing about the Civil War, still very relevant today. I am excited and honored to introduce our guest for this 10 o'clock hour, but let me just also mention we're on 2 hours these days. It won't be forever, but at the 11 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about the rally held on Friday, which was D-Day, in support of veterans. That's the 11 o'clock hour. But right now, I am, again, very honored to introduce C.R. Gibbs, a beloved historian, native Washingtonian, author of many books, many people have heard him. I'm surprised that many of the younger folks do not know C.R. Gibbs. So we are going to do what we can to make sure that everybody in D.C. knows Mr. C.R. Gibbs. He's written one of the many things he's done. He did a 13-part series to PBS's The Civil War. He's been a frequent guest on PFW over the decades, on often with Ambrose Eilane Sr. and these days as well, Ambrose Eilane Jr., as well as on this show, To Heal DC. He has a lot to share. And with that said, welcome, Mr. Gibbs. Uh-oh, can you hear me?
Can't.
You cannot hear? Okay.
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, welcome. I just introduced you, so welcome to our PFW audience.
I'm happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, we're going to try to invite you more. We need to be hearing you on a regular basis, the PFW audience. So you're going to speak today about at least two different topics. But I wanted to start out, I don't know if you might want to make a comment about what we heard happened over the weekend in Los Angeles with those ICE raids. I just wanted to quickly announce that I got word this morning that at 12 noon right here in D.C., there's going to be a rally to demand that the ICE raids are suspended, stop immediately. That's being convened by the D.C. labor movement folks, as well as CASA. It's going to be at 12 noon at the Department of Justice, 1001 Pennsylvania Avenue. And again, that's with the Metro Washington AFL-CIO. So that's to protest against the really quite fascistic activities that are taking place. But unfortunately, it's not totally new. But welcome, Mr. Gibbs.
Yes, Joni, you're right. It's not totally new. I'm reflecting on, and I know we'll talk about the Underground Railroad in Anacostia, and you know, in a little bit. But I was reminded that it was not uncommon for the police to break in to the houses of Black people who were working on the Underground Railroad in D.C. And we sometimes it's not taught in the schools, and we're not going to get into, you know, why that isn't. But the important thing is that once you know history, you know that there really is, as the poet said, nothing really new under the sun. They did this in D.C., led by a particularly vicious man. Some people called him Captain Goddard. And he was the kind of individual that, I mean, he was a fully fleshed member of the slaveholding aristocracy in the nation's capital. They don't much teach that, but it's important that we get the word out that the battle that you see playing out in Los Angeles continues and in many ways was presaged by what was happening here in the nation's capital and in the Deep South and in places even in the North, where people who just wanted to be free, who just wanted to have an opportunity, ran into people who didn't believe that we should have either. And that battle is an old battle and will continue until the day of peace and comity comes upon us.
Absolutely. And let's just quickly announce, Mr. Gibbs, and we'll announce this at the end of the show as well. Thankfully, you speak, I think it's at least once a month or often, at a D.C. library, and you have a speaking engagement coming up, I think it's next week. So share with our listeners now, and we will repeat it again, where people can hear you next week, live in person.
I am. Every third Tuesday of the month, I am at 6 o'clock at the Woodridge Library. The Woodridge Library. Now, please, y'all, do not drive to Woodbridge, Virginia. We're talking about Woodridge in Northeast D.C., roughly 18th and Rhode Island Avenue. And on Tuesday, I believe it's the 17th, I will be doing Emancipation USA. And what it is it's a comparison and contrast of how freedom came to the nation's capital, how it came to Maryland and Virginia and Texas. So you get a bunch of them all at one time. Again, it's Emancipation USA. I'll never forget this particular presentation because I was asked to do it at what we call NMOC, the African American Museum of History and Culture down on the Mall. And so that keeps it certainly special with me. But so you can sort of put these things in the proper historical perspective and so that you can understand the overlapping impact of them, come on down to the Woodridge Library. Again, not Woodbridge, Virginia, but in D.C., in Northeast D.C., just at 18th and Rhode Island Avenue at 7 o'clock. Excuse me, at 6 o'clock. Let me get it
right.
So come on down, check it out, and listen to the process, learn about the process, which is we're still fighting for full freedom. But it's important to see how this got started. Who were some of the people that helped us in those critical days and something that, remember, things have changed. We can no longer assume, oh, they'll get it in school, so you can put your feet up and assume someone else will teach your children. I believe it was Brother Malcolm who said, you know, how many people let their enemies teach their children? So we've got to do that. It's really simple. We have to do that job. We did it before. We're doing it now, and more of us will be involved in the education and, if you will, reclamation of the minds of our children. We've got to do that.
Absolutely. So, listeners, again, that is a week from tomorrow, and I believe it is June 17th, Tuesday.
June 17th.
Yes, Tuesday at 6 p.m. And I'm always delighted to see so many PFW listeners attending. So the room can fit a few more of you, and it'll be quite an important discussion. So we're going to talk about at least two things today. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about D-Day and African-Americans' involvement with D-Day. And D-Day was this past Friday, June 6th. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about the Underground Railroad history that people may not know, and the linkage with an event that's happening on Saturday with Adasi, African, well, maybe you can say it.
Well, Adasi is, if you leave it at that and keep it simple,
yes,
more people are likely to remember. And you come across the bridge. There's a wonderful celebration. We have a, and by the way, Adasi stands for African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute. And so there is the 33rd annual Maafa Commemoration and Riverwalk Healing Ceremony. And we tend to associate the Underground Railroad with Harriet Tubman and people, you know, outside of D.C., but this happened here as well. And if you go to just a little place, you know it well as you come off the bridge into Anacostia. We're talking about the intersection of Martin Luther King and Marion Barry. For you old-timers, that would be Good Hope Road and Martin Luther King. There is a building, let me give you the infallible landmark, which is a building called, appropriately enough, Enlightenment. And next to the Enlightenment building is a plaque done by Adasi, and it's beautiful. It is carved, it's bronze, and it tells the story of the struggle, focusing on the Underground Railroad in the nation's capital, which we don't do enough of. So we don't have to go too deep into Maryland or Virginia. This is something that we can sympathize and empathize with right here, right? Everybody knows where I'm talking about. And if you need another landmark near the old Anacostia liquor sign, if you can make it there, if you can make it across that bridge, the bridge that meant so much to so many people who risked their lives to get out of the suffering of slavery in Maryland and to get it. Not that D.C. was perfect. Got to understand, it was dangerous. That individual that I talked about, Captain Goddard and other people, I mean, he did something similar. Not only did he break into homes, he broke into anything where he thought freedom-seeking, progressive blacks and whites went. He did something similar at the intersection of Eastern Avenue, okay, and going right in, and Georgia and Eastern. He did that in the summer of 1850. If you can imagine, you're in a carriage, probably the lights are turned down on the outside perimeter of the carriage. And then right as you cross from one jurisdiction into another, someone threw a fence rail into the rear wheel. The man, a brother in the struggle, white man named William Chaplin was driving the coach. He was pulled down and thrown off the top of the coach. The bloodlust was up in the posse. They wanted the two freedom-seeking black men who were inside the coach. They, brothers and sisters, they stabbed the exterior of the coach. They shot into the exterior of the coach, and almost in something that sounds like it would come out of today. Then they blamed the people who were trying to get away on the Underground Railroad as, oh, they were the ones doing the shooting. So some things just simply don't change at all. And this is right at the intersection. Y'all have been across it, past it, so many times. Eastern Avenue and Georgia Avenue. The good news is that they have put a wayside sign up on the right-hand side near Jessup Blair Park so that you can see what happened on that extraordinary night in the history of the Underground Railroad right there on the border between Maryland and D.C. I wish that they would take the children there so that they could see it, and they wouldn't associate the stories of the Underground Railroad with just somebody that it happened in a book somewhere away from here. No, this is here in the streets and byways that you walk and drive through today. This is part of the history as much as the names of our streets, avenues, and boulevards. And we need to embrace that history. It's the history of the struggle. It is a history that, again, you cannot assume we're going to, oh, they're going to get that in school. Put that out of your heads. Take your babies, your children, your families, and so they can learn the history of the struggle in a way that will inspire them to share it, that they can take their children to a temple of freedom right there at Georgia and Eastern Avenue, or coming back closer to the Anacostia River. Can we believe that these kinds of things happened? And thanks to Adasi, and again, that is the African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute, they're going to tell the story. And they've done this in a marvelous, well-executed plaque right there near the intersection of Marion Barry and Martin Luther King. What more appropriate place could you put a sign of the freedom struggle that at the same time is near the former site of the bridge that hung between slavery and freedom? So that's how I wanted to encourage you there.
CR, if I can just announce that is on Saturday, that's going to be happening from 10 to 1. The people are meeting at Union Temple Baptist Church, and I think it's 11:30 is the River Walk. Of course, our own Tony Browder is going to be one of the speakers. This will be announced several times this week. I think Brother Kaba, who's on from 3 to 5 today, will be talking about it. And, of course, Tony Browder can be heard these days at PFW at 5 p.m. I'm sure he will be speaking about it again. So continue on, Mr. Gibbs.
Well, I wanted people to also realize that there was, if you will, right at the bridge and on the D.C. side, we actually had a nest of Underground Railroad operatives, if you will. For those of you who have interest in that sort of thing, there was a young man named Thomas Smallwood, who was a linchpin in the local Underground Railroad. And he lived about 4th Street, just right down from the bridge. He was involved in it. I think he was even one of the people that had his house broken into by Captain Goddard. But that didn't stop him. The point was that didn't stop him. And we can't let the forces of oppression stop us today. We've got to stand. One of the things about this is, can we do less than our ancestors? Time and time again, you've heard people on this station talk about how is it that the people who had so little were able to do so much, and we who have so much able or continue to do so little. So we've got to use the mark that was set by our ancestors. And so coming down from the bridge over the Anacostia and making a left turn, coming down toward the other bridge, which Frederick Douglass never used because it wasn't there at the time of his life, but I appreciate the fact that they named it. These were places in the Underground Railroad where you literally risked your life. You risked the lives of your family members. They weren't giving out roses because you were working for freedom. And again, some would say that's the way it is today, where we must be as dedicated. We must be as vigilant. We must be fearless in terms of fighting for freedom then and now. Young folk, within the sound of my voice, please don't get it twisted. Just because you hear doesn't mean things have changed to that great degree. That the struggle for freedom and justice and opportunity is as vital and as necessary today, in your day, as it was in the days of our ancestors. So I wanted to share that and let you know that this is accessible history, that what's going to happen next Saturday on the 14th, that's accessible. So come down to, and again, you're going to hear people talk about it many times on this station.
Absolutely.
And
Mr. Gibbs, it's also going to be, I think, accessible on your computer. It says AdasiAncestors.org. So if you can't make it out in person, I believe you can listen to it. And Mr. Gibbs, maybe we could consider some kind of way for PFW as we move forward to help organize some gatherings or journeys with young people to show them these spots. We have organizations and people that can probably help do that. That needs to be done. I must say, although I was raised in New York City, my parents certainly took me since one of my first memories was going to visit some of these Underground Railroad sites in New York. And of course, growing up in New York with the subway, I had to learn what they really meant when they talked about the Underground Railroad. So it's still important to see if we can organize this as an ongoing activity in this community moving forward. So anything else you want to share, Mr. Gibbs, about this part of history? Are you going to be there on Saturday?
I will stick my head in for a minute or two and be there as well. It's just that, if we don't tell the story, we have to take command of the story, people of goodwill, and make sure we can't leave this too important for you to leave it to someone else. And again, you don't have to go out and become a PhD or a no D will do. But if the D stands for dedication, by all means, join us. Come on out, learn this story and tell it. And that's only part of it. Looking at Anacostia River, we know that was a body of water that was involved in, and people were concerned about defending it. Yes, even Anacostia from attacks by the rebels. So there was even a defenses of the Anacostia in the Union Army and Navy. And there was even a Union ship named the USS Anacostia. So, and that vessel participated in the protection of the waters, particularly as we got closer and closer to the Chesapeake Bay. Again, these are stories. And yes, there were brothers from Anacostia and from D.C. that were part of what's called the Potomac Squadron or the Potomac Fleet that helped to fight to protect the waters of the humble Anacostia from Confederate depredations. And by the time you got closer to the bay, I mean, there were Confederate gun batteries. And in fact, that was, of course, one of the ways they fought. No less than the Benning Bridge. They had the Benning Road Bridge was patrolled during the Civil War, of course, by the Union Army. And at the beginning of the war, they would not let black people across. We know of one group of freedom seekers who made it somewhere from the interior of Maryland all the way down to the Benning Road Bridge and were turned back. I believe they were held for their masters. This is that history where we can't let one slow down. We can't let one seeming defeat turn us around. So I'll leave you with that and let you know that there's so much more rich history under our feet.
Absolutely. And again, it's a blessing. We're blessed to have Mr. C.R. Gibbs right here with us in the District of Columbia, native Washingtonian, sharing this critical history. And we're going to do what we can to make sure Mr. Gibbs is on even more frequently here on WPFW. And I want to also share, as you've been hearing, Sunday, June 22nd, PFW is going to have a very exciting Jazz and Justice event all day long at Malcolm X Park from 12 noon to 9 p.m. So there's going to be all kinds of not only music, but discussions and activities. So make sure you check out all the information that we're going to be sharing in the next 2 weeks about that upcoming event. So, Mr. Gibbs, do you want to move on to talk about D-Day? I must admit, I did not even realize that it was D-Day on Friday, even though I went to a rally, which we'll hear about in the second hour, that was organized by Unite for Veterans on Friday, June 6th. So, of course, not surprising, the role of I'm sure you're going to share the heroic role of African-Americans during D-Day is not discussed much at all. So we're happy that you can enlighten us and share that critical those critical stories.
Well, thank you, Joni. The emblematic of how we tend to get left out of history can be demonstrated in a D-Day Hollywood movie. Some years ago in the 60s, Hollywood produced a film called The Longest Day. And it showed you about many white units that were involved in the landings on the coast of France on the 6th of June, 1944. And so the beginning of the operation, that's D-Day. That's D-Day. If you wanted to look for a black man in that Hollywood movie, here's what you have to do. You have to sit in your seat until the end of the movie, just before the credits roll. And on the left-hand side of the screen, there is, and keep your eye on the left hand. Don't blink. There's one black guy that is shown marching off the beach. That's not the way it went down. And the Afro chain of newspapers, God bless the Afro, they produced a book during World War II called, I believe, This Is Our War. And it talked about the brothers who drove trucks on Omaha and Utah Beach. They risked their lives. We have the extraordinary example of the 320th Barrage Balloon Battalion. That was an African-American Army unit that saw combat on Omaha and Utah Beach. And these were the brothers that put up these big sausage-shaped dirigibles, if you will, over the beach. Their job was to protect the landing forces from attacks by German airplanes. The French recognized the members of the Balloon Battalion and medics from that unit before the American government did. Again, it is amazing how we tend to get left out. For those who want to get a better sense of it, if you run across pictures of the landings, particularly at Bloody Omaha, and you happen to see a big silvery object in the sky that looks like a sausage, that would be most likely the work of the 320th Mirage Balloon Battalion. This was a black unit whose mission was, you can't protect the beach if you get there late. You've got to be among the earliest landing parties on the beach so that you can put up your balloons and you can protect the beach. So, and the cable is attached to the land, again, in order to trap the German airplanes. Well, these brothers were just extraordinary. I mean, you're talking about a hydrogen-filled Mirage balloon, perhaps about 200 feet or so to defend soldiers landing on the beaches. They've got a commendation by Eisenhower for conducting, quote, its mission with courage and determination and proved an important element of the air defense team. They served in 140 days in France. And in late July 1944, Battery A of the 320th moved from Omaha Beach to the port city of Cherbourg in France. I mean, these guys were everywhere. And it seems that the major sustained coverage of the 320th Barrage Balloon Battalion was in the black press. So take when you get a chance, you Google them if you don't know about them. They were unique at Normandy for two reasons. It was the only American Barrage Balloon unit in France. And secondly, it was the first black unit in the segregated American army to come ashore on D-Day. Five battalion medics were the first to land on Omaha Beach at approximately 9 in the morning. A wounded medic, Waverly Woodson, was nominated for the Congressional Medal of Honor. Just to show you, we were there, not in the final waves. And I'm thinking about this, and it's personal to me, because I once heard a black DJ say, "Oh man, when it came to D-Day, the brothers stood back and let the white boys." That was an unfortunate remark. I called the station to register my displeasure at their inaccuracy.
Yes. Let people know you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. This is me, Joni, to Heal DC. We're honored to have Mr. C.R. Gibbs on with us for the hour until 11 o'clock in the second hour. 11, we're going to be talking about the rally last Friday on D-Day with veterans. This is very obviously extremely important what you're sharing, Mr. Gibbs. Do you know maybe roughly how many black veterans were involved with D-Day?
I don't know exactly how many, but I know that it was larger than just the size of the 320th. And again, one of the reasons I know this is because of the reporting of the Afro-American chain of newspapers and their production at the end of the war of a priceless book called This Is Our War, which now I checked with them and bought my own copy. I think it was last year, the year before, so that I would have that priceless history, a copy of it for myself, because there were also brothers who were driving, you know, 2.5-ton trucks along the beach at D-Day. We participated in other landings, but because this was the largest amphibious operation in American military history, it has a special importance for people who keep a track of those things. And again, I recognize that there are those among us who, that's the military. But nevertheless, when you shed your blood, when you put your life on the line, I will never forget being in St. Petersburg, Florida, and watching how those old men, they were old men then, a few years ago, how they handled their military service with great pride. However controversial it may be today, they served. They were men, as our Civil War veteran once said, we were natural men. We served. we didn't shirk our responsibilities. We showed we were as brave and intelligent, as courageous as anyone else. And just to prove that, I just want to share a little clip of an article about a man named Staff Sergeant Melville Jordan, who landed on D-Day in June 1944. And this is from the Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Friday, December 21st, 1945. And he goes on to say that he landed on D-Day on Omaha Beach, in the stretches of the shoreline in Normandy. And he will be here today or tomorrow, meaning he will be in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, because half an hour after he got off his transport, he was in New York. A brother was celebrating a bit. Then he headed home to hug his wife and his parents, Mr. and Mrs. A.M. Jordan. So if anybody knows the Jordan family or Chapel Hill, North Carolina, you can tell them Mr. Gibbs is reading about Sergeant Jordan, Melville Jordan. Sergeant Melville Jordan, and he was he was in what was called a port battalion. These are the men who, they were the man behind the man behind the gun. So we had brothers who were serving, like in the 320th Barrage Balloon Battalion, facing enemy fire. We also had thousands more who, through no fault of their own, were relegated to what they called in World War I the services of supply. These were the port companies who helped to load or unload these vessels. They were there who only stood and waited. They were there who, because their courage demanded that they stand by and be called on if they were needed. And Sergeant Jordan, Melville Jordan of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, was one of the individuals who landed at Normandy Beach. He went across with them, served in a supply unit called the Port Battalion. The battalion was under strafing. He says that the Germans shot at him while he was on Omaha Beach. He says 6 days. He said, and that half of the men in his unit were killed. Jordan moved half the men. He also landed and saw the blood in the sand as the men were moved back and forth. He was on the docks at Antwerp when the Germans bombed there. So, yes, our men. And this just in no way goes against the story of sisters. One of my own aunts that helped to raise me during World War II loaded bombs in a depot in Delaware. And she says that the gunpowder on the bombs, these American bombs to be dropped on the Germans or the Japanese, they turned the palms of her hands yellow and the whites of her eyes.
Wow.
My point being is that, you know, there were all kinds of ways that the brothers and the sisters served. We have to tell those stories. For many of us, again, this is something that is sacred, something that has to be told, and nothing that we can take for granted.
Absolutely. And I must say, in the 11 o'clock hour, the bottom of the 11 o'clock hour, we're going to be hearing from a sister who is in Cleveland she's going to be sharing some stories about that you never hear about Black women during World War II. So stay tuned for that. And Mr. Gibbs, is any of this history in the Smithsonian African American Museum?
Some is there, and I'm sure they have more that they could put out and make available to the public. I remember the anticipation about the opening of the museum, and an elderly gentleman used to call me periodically. How he got my number, I never knew, Joni. But he said, "Listen, I'm calling you. I want you to let me." I never met this man. I never knew his full name. And he said, "I'm calling you. I want you to tell me because I want to send some of my things to the Black Museum." That's what he said. "I want to send some of my things to the Black Museum." And I think a short time after the opening of the museum, he must have been able to do it because he stopped calling me. But again, can you imagine? He had been waiting for this for years. He called, calling a man that he, to my knowledge, I didn't know him. He didn't know me, but he got my number from somewhere. We cannot underestimate the importance of this story of this struggle. This is the largest conflagration, if you will, to strike this planet. We're referring to World War II. Many of you have items, you have uniforms, you have stories of the men and women who served. Save those. Don't sell them. Save them. And so that you can pass them down through your family so that they can be as precious not only to your family but to the country as you can possibly make them. Be your own custodian for a time. Make sure your grandchildren see them and touch them and protect them as well. Make them part of the effort. This is history that, again, if we don't take care of it, we are helping to super add to the crime of people who would traduce and destroy our history.
That's absolutely correct. And again, we are blessed to listen today for the hour to Mr. C.R. Gibbs, our beloved historian, native Washingtonian. And we're so thankful to have him right here on our airwaves. And Mr. Gibbs, it was interesting at this rally on Friday on D-Day, there was a flyer being passed around. And unfortunately, I can't put my hands on it right now, but they were warning people and letting people know that this so-called president is trying to erase even more some of this history of soldiers and of veterans, what you're describing. They're doing whatever they can to erase all of this even more than it already is. So I'm sure we'll be able to share that information that they were sharing, if not today, then in the future. But it's quite something. And if we had time, Mr. Gibbs, I know that there are people listening who had relatives that fought in World War II, particularly African-American folks who had relatives in that war. I don't know if we can sneak in a call or two, but we thank you, and we honor you for sure. So keep going.
Well, I wanted
Mr.
to
Gibbs.
Before we go, just two people who saw the courage of the brothers and sisters who served in World War II. Norman Lear. Some of you will know that name. The Hollywood producer, All in the Family, the Jeffersons. He was in some of those bombers during World War II, and he talked about the relief he would feel when he saw the Red Tails, when he saw the Tuskegee Airmen show up with the Red Tails on their planes, because he knew he was going to be protected. That stayed with him and proved to be a motive force in how he became progressive in terms of the depictions of black people in the on television, because he had seen the courage of these men in their flying machines, if you will, their P-38s and P-47s, P-51s. He knew that these men were fearless. And the other person I would mention, and finally, is the great Hollywood director, which he had done more with his opportunities. But I guess he considered himself having told some portion of the story. His name was John Ford. If we have any Hollywood folk in here that are familiar with them, he did a film focusing on the black soldiers, the Buffalo soldiers, called Sergeant Rutledge. But he was on the beach on D-Day, and he says, and I'll close with this, he says, I remember one colored man in an amphibious vehicle, it's called a duck, loading with supplies. He dropped them on the beach, unloaded, went back for more. I watched him fascinated. Shells are all around him. The Germans were really after him. He avoided every obstacle and just kept going back and forth and back and forth, completely calm. I thought, by God, if there's any man who deserves a medal, that man does. And that was the great Hollywood director John Ford talking about something that he saw with his own eyes. Again, we have to testify, y'all. We have to tell our history, whether it's ancient, whether it's modern, whatever it may be. We must be this generation's tellers of the stories, Jegnas, Jelly Mooses, Griots. We must all be engaged.
Absolutely. We still have about 5 minutes left, thankfully, Mr. Gibbs. Let me just ask you a question about that film. Say the name of the film again that you were discussing, John Ford's.
Oh, The Longest Day. Yeah, again, if you don't watch it, any of it until the end, you can't afford to miss it. Right before the credits roll, keep your eyes focused on the soldiers marching off of what is supposed to be one of the D-Day beaches. And again, on the side, on the left-hand side of the screen, you will see one black soldier. And, of course, the army was segregated. So how this brother got there in Hollywood's telling of the story, we don't know. But maybe somebody got a guilty conscience. I can't say. But it did show one guy, as the movie's going on, one black man on the left-hand side of the screen marching off into France as a result of the successful prosecution of the D-Day landings.
And I'm thinking, I don't know if this is related, but right after World War II, there was, of course, the McCarthy period where Hollywood writers were banned from being shown. So I don't know if this is connected with any of these stories, but
we don't know. But what we can say is that the heroism of African American soldiers was in fact seen by people who should have been more voluble in telling the story. But at least we can share that these two individuals, John Ford and Norman Lear, were affected by what they saw and that they never forgot it. They were able to recall the courage that they had seen, that they had witnessed for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. And of course, these days when we think about reparations, certainly reparations are due for the veterans of that World War II. And as many listeners do know, that when they came back and being heroes from the war, and I hate to even say that, of course, what happened meant there were lynchings that took place of those veterans.
Of the, so, in uniform, including a soldier whose eyes were put out. He was blinded in a racially motivated attack. I would also say, I mentioned the medics from the 320th Barrage Balloon Battalion. One medic, Waverly Woodson, may have saved the lives of as many as 200 soldiers on the beach at Omaha. I mean, he black and white soldiers. His officer recommended him for a DSC. That's a Distinguished Service Cross. And this is on D-Day. This was courage displayed on D-Day. 200, perhaps as many as 200 soldiers. I mean, they ultimately gave the brother a Purple Heart. He was approved to get a bronze medal in 1945, but wasn't awarded it, being redeployed out of Europe. So the feeling is prevalent among Negroes that had Woodson been of another race, the highest honor, a medal of honor, would have been granted him. So we've
definitely
got again, the story goes on and on and on. Joni, I want to thank you for being gracious enough to give me an opportunity to share some of my research and sources with you today.
Well, it is my honor and our honor to do so. And let's remind listeners, they can hear you live in person a week from tomorrow. That is Tuesday, June 17th at 6 p.m. at the Woodridge Library. And Mr. Gibbs, just repeat what you'll be talking about. People can come here.
A lecture called Emancipation USA. And it is the story of how freedom came to the district, to Maryland, Virginia, and Texas. So it's putting him in place in the struggle, these steps to freedom that ultimately resulted in the 13th Amendment.
Wow. And that is 6 p.m. sharp at Woodridge Library, 6 p.m. till 8 p.m. And they definitely need to close at 8 p.m. So you want to be there and get your front row seats or your back row seats. Meet some of the other PFW listeners who I know will be there. So this is, of course, next week will be Juneteenth week. And Mr. Gibbs will be integrating all of that into his discussion, I'm sure. So, again, we are honored to have you, Mr. Gibbs. And I know I'm looking forward to seeing you. If not before, I hope to see you a week from tomorrow at the Woodbridge Library, 6 p.m. And anything else you want to say about how people might keep in touch with you? Or?
Well, they can always, of course, go to portofharlem.net and look for me on that website. Brother Wayne Young does his best to take good care of me.
Yes, he does.
I'm off doing one thing or another, but thanks to him, you always have access to my schedule. There are portions of lectures and articles that are right there at portofharlem.net/C. Gibbs. But if you forget the /C. Gibbs, you go to Port of Harlem. He's made a way for you to find me if you can make your way to portofharlem.net.
Wonderful. Okay, Mr. Gibbs, you may want to hang with us as we go out with a closing song. And then we're going to be coming back at 11 o'clock talking about the rally last Friday with veterans on D-Day. And again, this Saturday, well, there's a lot going on. But let's go. I want to thank Mike Nasella, our wonderful engineer. And let me mention again, today at 12 noon, there is an emergency rally demanding that the ICE raids be stopped immediately. That's going to be 12 noon at the Department of Justice, which is 10-01001 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, and that is being organized by the Metropolitan Washington AFL-CIO and CASA. So let's go out with Sweet Honey and the Rock Sojourners Battle Hymn.
We are done with holding on. We are calling Yankee soldiers just as sure as you are born. When the rebels hear a shouting, they will think it's Gabriel's horn as we go marching on. They will have to pay us wages, the wages of their sin. They will have to bow their foreheads to their colored kith and kin. They will have to give us household room, or the roof will tumble in.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. on, synchronize your time, and let's
The 2025 Home Rule Music Festival opens Friday, June 13th with a dynamic youth musical showcase at Woolly Mammoth Theater, highlighting the next generation of go-go and jazz artists. Then, on Saturday, June 21st, the festival continues with a live performance by Backyard Band and Plucky and the Oneness of Juju, and other standout artists representing go-go and jazz. The festival also includes live DJ sets, record fair, vendors, and community activities. Details at homerulemusicfestival.com.
WPFW, in collaboration with the Josephine Butler Center, present the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. An activation of music, poetry, social justice teach-ins, visual art, wellness, children's activities, and more in Malcolm X Park. WPFW personalities Saiz Kamaluddin, Kaba Soul Singer, and Proverbs Reggae Band will be among the performers, with sets by DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog. Also featured will be an art show curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise and a community curated by Milani Douglas. Stay tuned to WPFW for updates and details.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
Equal Portions is delighted to join Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW, every Monday at 1 p.m. We're talking everything food justice, interviewing folks across all sectors, and playing the hottest new DMV music with your host, Stacia Lamira.
Hey, y'all. On Equal Portions, we'll be discussing all aspects of the way we interact with food, from the problems affecting our communities to the history and the story of the food around us and the local individuals within the food community. That's Equal Portions, Mondays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Freedom!
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Art Project present the 23rd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th, at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with films such as the U.S. premiere of Fanon and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th. Information at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.